Hi, everyone, and welcome to Episode 7 of Women in Retail Talks. I'm Caitlin Sullivan, Associate Content Editor for the Women in Retail Leadership Circle. In today's episode, we're excited to offer a presentation from our third annual Women in Retail Leadership Summit from Jules Pieri, co-founder of The Grommet, a product launch platform for makers. Listen in as she shares how video marketing has helped drive their brand toward success.
So I'm going to go a little off my topic. I'm going to use the topic a little differently. So I'm talking to you about discovering what's next, discovering the next big thing. And I will talk about that. But in traveling around, I realize there are a whole lot of you have entrepreneurial ambitions. There's lots of entrepreneurs in the room, actually. But not as many people raise their hands as who actually want to do this. There are a lot of you. And I'm an entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School, and it's something I address a lot. I go there twice a month, and I meet with eight teams or individuals to talk about that, either their career or their venture or their potential venture. And all those people always have the same two questions, and the same two questions I'm hearing from you guys, which are, how do I know if I'm cut out for this? And how do I know if this venture, this idea, is big enough to throw it all over for it? And so I thought I'd touch on those two topics before I go into what I was planning to talk about. So the first one, how do I know if I'm cut out for this? First of all, it's an impossible question, right? If you haven't done it, you don't know. How could you know? But I always look at patterns in your life around being independent and picking the harder road. Because being an entrepreneur, you're doing the non-obvious, as we heard earlier, and you should be. If you're doing something that's so obvious that everybody else can see, it's probably too late. So it's automatic. You have to be independent, and you have to be brave and tenacious. So look at examples in your life where you might have done that and survived. So it could be, you know, running a marathon. It could be taking a lateral promotion when that wasn't obvious, instead of the big job. It could be moving overseas. It can be things that are as simple as like showing up when someone's sick. I know that doesn't sound like entrepreneurial, but it's harder to do that than to not show up. So those roads that you took where either was fear or difficulty and you survived and you built a well of confidence that you can draw on for that potential venture. My own example, that would be when I was 14, I sent myself to boarding school. I was living in Detroit, tough neighborhood. Nobody in my family had ever been to college. And I just couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take the schools. And so I figured out how to get out of there. And that was the most terrifying thing, the most entrepreneurial thing I've ever done. I was literally nauseous every morning before I went to class. And so now, I mean, I've done really hard things in the context of this business. I can remember that 14-year-old self and draw on the strength of that person. And I want to tell you guys something I would never tell the HBS students because they're too young. The average age to start a business is 47. That's when I started my business, actually, 47. You wouldn't think that from the media, right? It looks like 27-year-old guys in hoodies. And those are the guys I hang around with, believe me. But I am so much better, and you are so much better for whatever age you are that's not 27. I couldn't have done this at 27, and it's for a couple of reasons. One is speed. I'm decisive in a way I wouldn't have been then. I have a playbook. It's also networks, because being resourceful as an entrepreneur is the most essential thing you can do. But it's also risk-taking in that when you're say 47, you already have a career behind you. You have a whole cadre of people who think you're pretty great. You've done things, right? So you can live on the edge of this venture taking risks, because it's not personal if you fail. It'll hurt, it won't be fun, but it's not personal. You have that base. And that's super important to your ability to push the business and take it where it needs to go. And I see all these young entrepreneurs throw their great idea over too fast because they can't take that personal risk. They don't have the ballast. And the other ballast that's super important that you all have in some form or another is the personal ballast, because it's extremely emotional, extremely difficult to pursue a venture. The ups and downs are like nothing you'd see in a corporate career. And in my case, I have three sons and a husband, and I wasn't building that part of my life simultaneous to accompanying these poor young entrepreneurs are trying to acquire a partner and maybe build a household and maybe have children at the very same time they're building a company, and that's incredibly important stuff that should be a central focus of their lives. But the venture sucks up all the air in the room, and those two things don't go together very well. So being older is actually a huge advantage in terms of not just the cheering squad and the stability, but literally time. Of course, we're busy, but you've got a lot of things going. So I just wanted to share that with you, because some of you are asking me these exact questions, and I thought it's almost more important than what I'm going to talk about next. But I'm going to talk about next, the other thing. The other question, I didn't answer it, sorry. How do you know if it's the right idea? And again, another impossible question. I'm going to give you a really simple answer. Is it a big idea? Because I see too many, I deal with entrepreneurs all day long, 300 of them a week are coming across our transom. And it pains me when somebody pursues something that's too small, unless it's truly a lifestyle business. But if you really want to make that sort of dent in the universe, you really want to have potentially a large financial success, you really want to be an author of something visible, meaningful, it should be a big, big, big opportunity. And you guys, again, you assess opportunity all day long. These 27-year-olds do not know what an opportunity is if it hit them in the face sometimes. They just haven't had enough life experience. And they go after these teeny, crazy things that are solving a problem in their life that's going to last for about 6 months. And you guys know what real customers want, what real world needs. So go for something big. And there's another reason you should go for something big, which is not fame and glory and money. It's that you don't have to be a genius. If you go for something really small, you've got maybe one shot on goal to get it right. If you go at something big, you've got a lot of shots on goal. You can get it wrong. And in my case, in my business, what that means to me is I have a lot of streams of revenue. And that's intellectually really interesting to me, but obviously financially really interesting to me. So go for something big. Don't limit yourself at all. Okay, those are the two questions I wanted to touch first. But let me go over to what... Can I go to slide 16? I'm just going to jump over a bunch of stuff. We got to talk about some of it yesterday anyway. It's actually back a couple. It's a brown slide. Oh, no, sorry, you were right. Never mind. I think you were right, that one. Okay, so how do we discover the next big thing? Remember, this is what we do all day long at the Grommet. We launch one product a day. And we do some things, 300 ideas a week. How do we find them? How do they come to us? Some of them are conventional means. We do go to trade shows, just like you, but we probably don't go where you go at that trade show. We're hanging around in the back of Beyond, where these quiet little tiny ugly booths are. Nobody's talking to these people. We're there at that like terrible corner of the trade show if we're there. We're also judging startup competitions kind of behind the scenes at those trade shows. So we're traveling in sort of different ways, sort of like, the rats in the subway at the trade show. That's what we are. We work really directly with the crowdfunding platforms, which is a terrible place for a retailer to find products. I mean, it's just way too much work. You just don't know who you can trust and who's going to really produce. We have direct relationships with the platform, so that really helps us to get at the good guys, basically. And we can take more risk with them so that if they're terrible, it won't kill us like it could kill you. Social media are super active, so both outbound and inbound. We have just amazing feelers all over all of the social networks to lead to really great ideas. Inbound, we have a place where you can submit. So if any of you ever do have a product, know we're there for you. You can submit your product to us. We look at absolutely everything that comes across. It's basically our CRM. And our own discovery team, you might call that merchandising or media, we call it discovery. They're very, very visible because when we started the business, we decided that we would actually personally be on video. We release a video every day. It was horrible in the beginning. My co-founder and I did not want to be on video. So anyway, when you have a human face on the business, people can find you. They know how to find you. And it really encourages a really high quality of submissions. Referrals are really important to us. While we've all been sitting here, I have been dealing with a ton of referrals from over email, referrals from entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, angel investors have been sending me products. I've been batting products around for 2 days here like I do every day. How we evaluate things, we do actually physically test everything. That's absolutely essential. It kills me when I look at that. I hire people sometimes from the deal-a-day sites, and they never even touch the product. The merchandise have never seen it. And maybe that's common, but to me that's anathema. That would never happen in our business. We have to know this product is trustworthy. We have to know it performs. Similarly, user feedback, the minute we launch a product, the maker of the product has to be available online to answer questions. So at the moment of discovery, there's no place in retail, online retail, where that happens, where you can talk to the maker at the moment. And that really speeds up the maker's understanding of the product features they might be missing, pricing, use cases, things that they wouldn't think of in their own little garage. Also, we use, obviously, reviews like anyone else. If a company's products don't perform over the long haul in the way we expected, then we'll have to retire them. They just can't be a grommet permanently. And finally, competitive analysis is kind of obvious. We just see so much in every category that we know if it's a connected home device, how many, all the other ones as well. But that's more like classic merchandising. So you guys live in one of the most competitive and secretive businesses on earth. I mean, if you've been in retail your whole life, you may not realize, like, it really is as extreme as you feel. It really, really is. I've been in a lot of businesses. And obviously, you're not in business to help your competitors. And we are in business to share, actually, our success. It's a really different mindset because we're trying to make makers successful. We're not trying to hoard the best things that come across our transom. So we built a media platform. Obviously, we've done that to share these stories. And we've heard a lot about storytelling here, and storytelling is essential. It's central. It's that human connection to the person who created the product. And our community really decides what happens. We're not geniuses. We're probably about 70% right when we assess what the response is, both quantitative, commercially, qualitatively, might be to a product. And I celebrate that 30% when we're wrong, because we're not taking enough risk if it gets smaller. We have to be wrong a lot. Video, obviously central to what we do. And we operate in the maker movement. This is what a lot of people are calling kind of the collision of digital and physical. And in my life as an industrial designer, I've never seen anything as interesting as this. I mean, these last 5 years in particular, what data, the access to data within a physical product, and how that extends your access to the manufacturer, to retailers, to communities is amazing to me. So the statistics are showing what's really happening. These are patents. Look how they were sort of ticking along almost flat. And look at that, what's happening the last few years. This is a technology story. This is an economy story. And this is a role model story. People are seeing that they can do this. Kickstarter, Shark Tank, those kind of phenomena really, really matter to influence people's career choices. So a lot of people are calling this the third industrial revolution. And there are some big companies already being built in terms of companies like Nest, like Fitbit. But I really think of it as more of a small plus small equals big type of phenomenon. And for retail, that's kind of a difficult thing because you're almost having to go back to your roots and access these small companies and nurture them in a way that's uncomfortable if you're too big. It's not really part of your business processes. What we do within that is kind of simple. I've already talked about this, but basically their hair on fire problem is I've built a better mousetrap. No one cares. Nobody can find me. So that's what we're cracking, giving them their sea legs and then building validity and honestly stress testing these companies to get them ready for you, get them ready for prime time. So I want to show you one specific product just to give you a sense of how we operate. There's a video on this one. Could you guys, I don't think I can manipulate the video. If you guys could just play it, and I just want to play about 30 seconds of it.
The 21st century has not been kind to those of us who like to fix things. Many household items are made of plastics or other materials that just aren't easy to fix. Until now. Bondic is a liquid plastic welder that allows you to fill in broken or even missing areas. Even better, it gives you the time you need to get it just right. That's because Bondic won't harden until you use the supplied UV light. Bondic was created by a German dentist who realized that the adhesives they used for dental work had a lot of other uses. He partnered with Rob Harbauer to launch Bondic right here in the US.
Dr. Tom, my dentist, is actually the person who came up with it.
I just wanted to show a little snippet of that. We do this every day. So this is what happened on Bondic the day we launched it. This is literally like the first, few hours, or maybe it's 24 hours. 24 hours. So really big spike. This is partly why I say we kind of know within an hour what's going to happen. We have a lot of commercial and social and qualitative data within an hour. But then we watch it further. So this was Bondic over 120 days. It crested over a million ultimately within half a year. And so we're really seeing a meaningful product that if you saw it on the store shelves, you would walk right by it. Right? You would walk right by it. You don't imagine this could exist. You're not Googling for it because you don't know it exists. And there's a huge role in the world for us, all of us, not just Gromit, to play, to find and celebrate these companies. The White House is all over this, believe it or not. They had their first Maker Faire in 2014, and they invited us to be there. It was really cool. I'd never even been there. We were part of a very small community of people who support the maker movement in getting to express our own business commitment to seeing this maker movement move from what some people might think of as a DIY sort of inventor, hacker, science fair thing to a real business phenomenon. So the reason they invite us is we were introducing our wholesale business, where, as I mentioned yesterday, we've been creating basically a route for these products to independent retail, but a lot of them are ready for you. I'm going to leave with a final thought that's back to you. Whether you as an entrepreneur, whether you as a consumer, whether you as a business person, one thing that's super important to me is that we all think about the power we have in our really simple actions of sharing, talking about, and buying products. And I like to frame it as a 10% commitment. A lot of what we buy, 85% of what we buy, is kind of committed, right? You're rebuying what you've bought before. If you're going to buy a car, you have to buy it from a big company. But think about taking 10% of what you buy and direct it directly, very thoughtfully, against your own values, what you really, really care about, whether it's supporting women and women behind enterprises, whether it's about supporting green enterprises and sustainable living or domestic manufacture. Whatever it is, just think about taking that 10%. The collective power of that is absolutely massive. We call it citizen commerce in our business. It's bigger than us, bigger than our business, it's you. So I'll just leave you with that final thought. 10%, grab it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Women in Retail Talks. This episode will be available on iTunes and Stitcher, but please don't forget to subscribe on our podcast channel page as well. Lastly, if you want to learn all things women in retail, connect with us on social. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at WIR Leadership. Thanks, and I look forward to you joining us on the next episode of Women in Retail Talks.